You're listening to the Sarah Fader podcast. This is what anxiety feels like. We're here with so many people. We have Evan Morgenstern, we got Aura Bishop, and we got Ross Trowbridge. I was going to fuck up your name, so I had to like stutter for a minute. And before we even get to how awesome Ross is, because we're going to be talking about borderline personality disorder, let me just say we are proudly sponsored by Ravishly.com. And woo-hoo! And in case you live under a rock where my trolls tell me to die, we interviewed Joni Edelman, who is the chief editor of Ravishly.com, where they have fun, feminism, animals, life.
Yeah.
We talk about like oatmeal sometimes, but I've written for Ravishly. Ravishly is so great. Follow them on Twitter, Ravishly, D-O-T-C-O-M, R-A-V-I-S-H-L-Y, D-O-T-com. So, Aura.
Yeah.
Aura is the director of sponsorship for our podcast.
I am, yeah.
And we're so excited because Aura and Evan are having a sleepover at Evan's apartment.
That sounds a lot more interesting than it is.
It is non-sexual. But anyway. go ahead.
We're pretending I'm his cousin right now.
Yes, in order to get through my landlord who is weird about people. Yeah, I don't even know what else to say, but yes.
Okay.
He's going to start thinking I have a lot of cousins.
Right. That's good. So, we're here with Ross Trowbridge, and Ross is an advocate, a mental health advocate. He has lived with BPD, borderline personality disorder, since his teen years. He was misdiagnosed several times and finally got the right diagnosis and was able to finally start to heal. And Ross, welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah. And actually, Ross, tell us about how you came to be a guest on the podcast. What happened on Twitter? What did I say and what did you say?
Well, you were looking for somebody that, you know, that wanted to come on. And I said, I'm more than happy to if you'll take me. So, you know, I've listened in before and I'm somebody who I'm not afraid to talk today. I used to be an introvert. Today, I love to talk about mental illness. I love to talk about borderline. And there's a couple reasons why. Number one, I love to help other people, and I believe that is a part of my purpose to relay a message. And since I have the capability of communicating that message, number two, I need to be reminded on a daily basis that I have a deadly mental illness that kills at least 10 to 15% of those afflicted at some point in their lifetime.
Wow.
And if I forget that, then I'm in danger. So
yeah, that's go ahead, Evan.
I just want to say, whereas there's nothing wrong with people who don't want to come forward and talk about what they have, it's so very brave and so very helpful that you're doing this and to come out with this. And, you know, the cliche of let people know that they're not alone.
Yeah, absolutely. And borderline is a highly stigmatized, misunderstood diagnosis, especially with regard to men, because men typically get misdiagnosed with bipolar or other issues like substance abuse disorders. And it's actually underneath borderline. And I have a great friend that I've interviewed on this podcast named Dr. April Foreman. On Twitter, she's at Doc Foreman. She exclusively treats clients with borderline. And what she said to me was so interesting. Borderline is like a staph infection. And underneath that staph infection are many different things. It is the overarching diagnosis. But borderline can be cured. If somebody goes into DBT and they work really, really, really hard, you can go into remission from BPD. But underneath, there's always something. So the staph infection is cured, but there's still some kind of wound. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't mean to disagree with you on your own podcast.
Yeah,
but this is,
you can absolutely. I mean, this is not my opinion. This is what I was told by someone who treats BPD.
Yeah. So, but everybody can, I think, can look at it differently and how, you know, how it helps them. And some, and I made the mistake though, for me personally, to look at being in remission. And the reason is this, is I, everything was going great in my life this was, you know, 2 years ago. And I had the mentality that I was in remission, and boy, did I get a swift kick in the ass, and I got it quick, because all of a sudden it hit me, and I went from having a job and being fine to being homeless on the streets of Des Moines, Iowa.
Right.
So I changed my mentality a little bit.
Right.
And I don't personally use remission anymore. What I do is I talk about, or I think of it as a minute by minute, day by day, managing the disorder. Either it's one of two things. I'm either managing it at the current time or I'm not. If I'm not, then I will know it, and others around me will know it pretty damn quick.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And that makes sense, because sort of, as much as we can try to manage our mental health issues, it might get better, it might get worse, but it, because of the nature of mental health issues, it might, you don't even know when it might just pop right back up at its worst.
Everybody is different. So yes. I think what she was saying is not that this is true for every BPD person, for everyone who deals with borderline, but it can happen.
Yes.
And so the thing is that the most effective treatment for borderline that has been documented is DBT, or dialectical behavior therapy. And it actually is effective for the reason that you indicated, which is that it's like behavioral therapy, it's like CBT, but it has mindfulness. And so what happens is, when you do that, right, like you said, moment by moment, let me figure out what I'm feeling. Let me pay attention to how to manage those feelings. That is a huge part of borderline.
Can I talk about a little bit about DBT?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I haven't had the luxury of having DBT therapy. And I do see, you know, I know that it is the well documented that it is the most effective treatment for borderline.
Yeah.
But I also want to talk to people out there who don't have access to DBT therapy.
That's important.
And
that is, and very important. Yeah.
The way that I look at it is, I look at, everybody has a recovery formula.
Right.
Okay. There's a lot of variables within that formula. And if one of my variables are not working, I change it out with a different variable until I get the correct solution.
Amen.
So within my formula, I do a lot of things that may kind of, I guess, overlap with some DBT, but I do a lot of things, small tasks that I can accomplish every day, and it's not reinventing the wheel. And one of the things that I don't like about DBT, and I'm going to, you know, maybe I'll piss some people off here, but one of the things that I don't like is the complexity. And I know that, you know, there is some simplicity in the idea, but I see it all the time out on social media where people talk about, hey, I need to go back to DBT. I forgot some things. The formula that I have and that I'm working with that works for me today, there's not one thing that is complex about it. There's not a 240-page booklet. And so I know that it is, I'm not trying to bash it by any means, but in terms of my own recovery formula, I need simplicity. And that's just for me. Everybody is different. But I had to, because I don't have access to it, I had to do something really, I had to do something fast. So I had to figure out what to do by, you know, that is outside of the traditional dialectical behavioral therapy.
Absolutely. But I understand what you're saying 100%. The thing that people, I think, misunderstand about borderline is that it isn't that people with borderline are histrionic necessarily. Because that's a misperception or a misunderstanding. People, that a lot of times, and this is not every person, but many people that have borderline are in enormous amounts of pain. And so it's about managing your pain tolerance. Because when you are suffering, and you have, and it's actually like you're not managing what's happening very well, your pain tolerance is low. And so that's when you're going to go into substance abuse or hypersexuality or risky behavior, because your pain is so intense.
You know, I agree. I think it, for me, I always say that this is my mentality is to get to the bottom of my problem, I need to start at the top.
Bam.
And that's my brain.
Yeah.
You know, that is my brain. That is my thinking. What happens with me, I have very simple things that I think of throughout the day. And number one is, if I'm thinking in a positive way, I'm going to have positive emotions. If I have positive emotions, I'm going to act in a positive manner. If I act in a positive manner, shit doesn't go wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? That's very helpful. And also to remember, because I know what that's like. I struggle with negative thought patterns every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of us do. And I think one thing that can help is catching it and going, oh, wait, that's something that's negative. Let me reframe. But
I'm sorry. I challenge every, and this is,
yeah.
I'm very opinionated about stuff, but I challenge every negative thought. And this is exhausting, but I cannot pick and choose which negative thoughts that I decide to challenge, because if I let one slide, my day can be completely shot. So
yeah.
I literally, every day, when I have that instinctual thinking, that negative thinking, I challenge it immediately. And if I don't, I'm shot the rest of the day. I may as well just go to bed.
Yeah.
That sounds like it can be exhausting,
yeah.
Also so productive and so something that just like building blocks for your day.
Exactly. And I think what's so great about that, if you look at the positive of being so on top of your thinking and mindful of it, is that hypervigilance is actually going to make you super strong, because your insight is so high. And a lot of people don't have the insight to say, wait a second, I'm having this thought, I need to change or reframe it. So many people are content or complacent being unhappy, and they don't challenge those thoughts, not because they don't want to, because they see that they don't see another option.
People feed their own illnesses.
Yes.
I fed my own illness. And so what I did is, there's a reason why I fed my own illness, and there's a reason why I really was so stubborn and I didn't want to think positively. And this is why. It was easier for me to stay sick than it was to get better.
Yeah.
Because you know what? I felt comfortable in my own shit. I soaked in it,
yeah.
You know? And so what, you know, going into recovery is it exposes myself. It brings up vulnerability. It brings up fears. It brings up the possibility of failure. When I was ill, when I was in bed 23 hours a day, suicidal, I mean, this was every day for about 5 straight months and it was horrible. I was clinging onto life. You know, when I was doing that, I had no expectations of myself and I had no expectations from other people. So as soon as I started to get better, all of a sudden I had to expect things of myself and then others expected things of me. And that is a hell of a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it is.
I feel like people who don't have severe mental health issues, people don't understand, well, why don't you just we get better? And it's a lot of it is like you said, you're sort of in a weird way comfortable in your not comfortable but you're in your own place, and you know how you kind of know just how much it's exhausting to even think of the idea of trying to get better.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also there's this misconception that when you're in that place of doing the work to get better, so many people don't understand that some of that looks really ugly and it's not always pretty. And so they think that you're still wallowing in your crap or whatever. So it's sometimes easier to just stay depressed and angry, because people don't always see and understand and appreciate that you're working really hard. When you are working really hard to get better, it doesn't look like you wake up and you're happy, and
right.
It's a job.
And you have to look at the bad aspects of why you've gotten where you are and so forth.
Yeah, I kind of equated to this, like the being comfortable in your shit, right, thing, is I fall asleep in my clothes a lot. Mm-hmm. And then the next day I'm like, fuck it, I'm just going to wear the same clothes. Even though it's gross and I'm disgusting, right? Yeah. I'm just like, I'm just going to fucking do that because it's easy. But what's hard? Taking my fucking clothes off, taking a shower, and putting on new clothes. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, that's the analogy, right? Like, the analogy is, okay, this is comfortable, in quotes, but is it healthy? No. And so the thing is, it's about, like, that's my fucking everyday, right? Is waking up and going, I literally wake up every day and go, I don't want to do anything. Nothing. And every day is about self-talk. And what I was going to say about your story, right? Sorry, that's a vacuum cleaner. What you were saying was so relatable to so many people because, I mean, this is such a silly thing to say, but we all have borderline traits, even if we're not borderline, because that is a very distinct diagnosis that has very specific symptoms. Like, this is so ridiculous, and you'll probably laugh. My friend's friend, based upon my fucking Facebook post, goes, your friend's borderline, right? And I was like, wow, that's amazing. You can diagnose me on my Facebook statuses? Unbelievable. You know, but
your life is that simple, right?
You're a fucking internet PhD. Incredible. But the thing is that, like I said, so there's a distinction between having borderline, but me also having what? Abandonment issues, being very, having difficulty modulating feelings, you know what I mean? So there are things that we can relate to when we talk to somebody with BPD, even if we don't have it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. You know, I had a friend that, my best friend's name is Judd. He's 64 years old. I'm 38.
High five 38 club.
I'm getting there.
First guy that I've ever told him that I love him. I'm a heterosexual male, other than my father. He's taught me so much, but you know, I after 64 years, he was finally diagnosed, and we're gonna throw a party. He's moving back actually from Tucson, and he's officially BPD on paper. But there's a lot of things, like if I'm talking to somebody with mental illness, I can relate to anybody with mental illness, but honestly, with people with borderline, it's like talking to my twin.
Yeah.
And, we can finish each other's sentences, you know, and we can have totally different circumstances on why we got this, what the, childhood or adolescence trauma was. But it's so eerie similar, but, you know, one thing I did want to bring up and I talked about, you know, kind of one of, you know, my formula in recovery. And I think the one of the most, and I talk about feeding my illness, the thing that held me back the most is that I never held myself accountable.
Wow.
And, you know, accountability is so huge for me today. And you know what's really hard to hold myself accountable today is that I have to own up for my fuck ups in the past. I have to own up for my fuck ups now and my fuck ups in the future. And so, you know, and that I cannot pin that on mental illness. The mental illness only influenced my decisions. Never. Okay. My thinking and my emotions have never gotten me into trouble, only my actions. Now those actions were influenced by my thinking and emotions, but I am the one who's paying the price for my actions, good or bad consequences. And that's the mentality I have to take every day. And as soon as I got rid of that poor me attitude, and people get upset by my how I act, you know, and how I think about recovery, but I have a very direct approach. It is a no-nonsense. You know, if I don't want to do something that's healthy for me and my recovery, I better fucking do it.
Yes.
Bottom line.
You know what? I say this to many people that have mental health issues because it's a recurring theme. Put your fucking violin away.
Yes.
And throw it in the garbage, because you know what? That's going to get you nowhere.
Yes.
You can feel sorry for yourself for 10 minutes, put a fucking timer on, and move on.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
That's an important point. I think, you know, you bring up something very important. When you talk about the timer thing, I think there is something to be said about giving yourself the space to be aware of those feelings that you're having and acknowledge them and giving yourself some space to have them, but then you have to choose how to react to them.
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, with what I struggle with, I know there's going to be certain times when I'm going to have feelings that I can't really control. So I've really only stuck to this in the last 2 months, but it makes such a huge difference. Giving myself the space and the time to say, this is what I have to deal with this feeling. So I'm going to give myself this time to deal with it and have it and then move on.
Yeah. And I think there, because what happens sometimes with depression, I find, and maybe you guys can talk about this for yourselves and your viewpoint, is that we can get sucked into depression and we don't even realize it. And then all of a sudden you're like, how long have I been wallowing in this?
Oh, you know, yeah.
Right? And then, it's like about catching that and saying, you know, I'm going to allow myself to cry my fucking face off. And then I'm going to just redirect, go outside, call somebody. Because to me, I allow myself to just like feel that intensely as a sensitive person and then distract, do something else.
I have a step
of support.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, I just say like, and if you can surround yourself with people who understand or support it and give you that space.
Yeah,
hopefully that's hard though.
But and you know what? Another thing is, a lot of people won't get it, and that's okay. They don't have to.
Yeah.
As long as you understand you, and you're around people that do get it, it's okay. It's okay for people to not get you.
You know, I one of the things we're talking about, kind of the conflict, emotional conflict. I'm all about step by step in my head. I have mantras. I have all these little things throughout the day. If I have any emotional conflict with anybody or any situation, first thing I do is I feel the feelings. I don't ignore them. I feel the feelings. Number two is I accept the feelings. Okay, I own the feelings. There's no shame in it. This is what I'm feeling. And then number three is I look at both sides. Okay, if I'm having emotional conflict, I'm probably not getting my way and I'm being a big baby. Okay, so I look at both sides of the street. Okay, where are they coming from? And then I script a response. And this is very important for me because I am not an angry person, but boy, I can get passionate sometimes. And so if I feel strongly about something, it is critical that before I go back to somebody and give a response, that I script it in my head and I stick to that script and I do not go off it. Because if I get too passionate and too wound up, then I'm going to end up saying something I'm going to regret later on. And once I script a response and I do that part, then it goes back. It's the cycle again. Okay, if I'm in an emotional conflict, then it goes back to the beginning again. So somebody responds, then I get pissed off again, right? I do the same thing. I feel the feelings. I accept the feelings. You know, I script the response. And then hopefully then I move on. But that's just kind of a cycle process.
First of all, that is fucking genius. And I'm going to tweet it and quote you right now. You need to teach people that. Because hearing that is something I want to try. I want to try that as soon as we get off this podcast. Because there are people that I have trouble doing that with, and that is fucking genius. Seriously. Like, you could literally write a book with those three things. You know what I mean?
This is really
really insightful. Because the thing is, I relate to that as a sensitive person. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't respond, I react.
Yes.
So my thing is that is so useful to so many people, because what happens is we get overrun by our feelings and we're like, hey, that hurt my feelings right away without thinking about what you actually want to communicate.
Yes.
Right?
Well, it can almost come off as fake though. When I thought about this when I started this process and in this step-by-step process with any type of emotional conflict. But it may seem a little fake by the scripted response, but you know what? I don't give a shit.
Who cares? Because
That is going to save me so much trouble in the long run by sticking to being sticking to myself, staying on my side of the street.
Yeah.
Don't say you know, some basic communication skills. Don't say you, say me or I. And, you know,
I messages.
Messages. But and there's things that I tell you that I've had that conflict, and I was so proud after I did that, and it's like in. You know, it's just a great feeling to be able to act like an adult because
yeah.
I acted so many times like a little baby, a little child, a spoiled brat at times. And so it is empowering to actually follow through with
it. Wait, so what's the second one? Feel the feelings. What's the second one?
It's feel the feelings and it's accept the feelings.
Accept the feelings.
Because we so many times that we there's that shame and that guilt for feeling a certain way. And then you have other people kind of invalidating you on top of your own invalidation by saying, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. Well, fuck, you know, thanks. I'm a pro at invalidating myself. You just invalidated me even more.
Exactly.
Right? And like, thank you for telling me that there's a switch that I can just turn on and off and that's it.
Right. It's like,
so often we know that the feeling we're feeling maybe is more than it needs to be, or it may seem irrational. We're already aware of that. We know
yes.
that.
Ridiculous.
Someone else
right.
can tell
yeah,
us that.
It's like when people tell people with anxiety to calm down. I will never fucking forget that. I will
yeah.
never forget when this EMT was at my house. And of course, like sometimes the EMT comes with, you know, with the cops because they have to like accompany people. The fucking cop said to me, your anxiety is making this worse. You need to calm down. And I was like, you know what? I wish that there was a switch in my head that I could use to do that. But unfortunately, I have an anxiety disorder, which is a medical condition. So I'm doing the best that I can.
Society doesn't want to deal with that. Society, if they have to deal with it, then they have to pay attention, and it becomes too much.
Right.
And people don't believe in it sometimes. People
right.
don't, it's the same with mental illness.
They
if somebody
don't.
Has a panic attack or an anxiety attack, where especially for women, a women have it, I'm telling you, I mean, men have the stigma, but women look like they're emotional basket cases, they're attention whores, they're, and all this stuff. You know, men, they actually, we have I think a negative stigma, but I tell you, women have it worse in my opinion.
It's true.
I think.
Well, it's true. And I think men, I mean, the problem with our society with regard to men and mental health is not being able to express sadness and,
yes.
and being told that expressing sadness is weakness or,
mm-hmm.
you know, resembles something that isn't masculine. So
yeah.
that's a problem for our boys because when they cry and they're raised by people that subscribe to that, they're told they can't express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that perpetuates.
No one wants to listen.
But and then that sadness and that depression turns into anger because it's turned inward and it's bottled up. And then we have that's so much of what aggression is. It's not just aggression or masculinity. It's bottled up sadness and
it is.
Untreated depression.
And actually, in women, a lot of times it's the flip. So what happens is, as a woman, you're told you can't be angry. Don't express that. That's not feminine, and you are going against societal norms. So what happens? Your anger becomes depression. That's what happens, and it's very common that we are not allowed to feel our feelings as people for a variety of different reasons. So I just want to say that these steps that you have given us, I am dead ass serious. You should write a book with these.
No,
I'm not even joking. Because it is actually so simple, but revolutionary. It really, really is.
Really, really.
What you talk about writing a script, I know personally I've done something similar but instead of saying the script, I often have to write out, if I'm feeling a lot, I have to write out what I need and to convey to the other person and send them an email or send it in a text.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then I have, you know, I'll have other people get really frustrated. You sent me this long email. Oh my God. But it's like, if I don't do this, I'll say something I'll regret. I'd rather say too much or be too formal or put it in writing than otherwise, you know,
lashing out or saying something out of anger. Yeah. I mean, I think the script is so great, and I was relating to that. I remember when I had a conflict with my therapist, and I was like, I don't know why I'm angry at you, or like I was thinking in my head, and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to write down exactly how I feel so that I can say it to her when I go into the session. And that script, Ross, was like so helpful because I didn't forget anything I was feeling. And she came back and said, she wasn't judging me for writing a script because she's my therapist, but she's also awesome.
Well,
and she was like, wow, I didn't realize that I hurt you like that. I am sorry. And then I think part of the reason for that is that writing it as a script elucidated my feelings.
Well, you know, another thing too is by writing the script or just coming up with the script. Mine was just in my mind. I basically prepared my response to the emotional conflict, but it forces me to step out of the situation. Okay, so that's another step in that process too. That's a part of writing of preparing a script.
Oh, step out of the situation. That's good.
Because you're forced to, because it's not like you're going to be in this conflict and then you're going to be like, oh wait 30 seconds. I have to come up with my response. You know, you literally have to step out of the situation and then come up with and sometimes you have to calm down. I had to calm down. And that's where feeling the feelings and accepting the feelings are key, because it gives me an opportunity to calm down.
Okay.
And I'm not going to calm down if I feel shame or guilt about those feelings.
So I have feel the feelings, accept the feelings, see both points of view, step out of the situation, and script a response.
That's right. And then back to the beginning again.
Repeat.
Based on what, yeah.
Repeat. You should name that. Like,
yeah.
What would you name it, if you could name it anything?
George, I like that name.
Yes.
Yes.
Nice.
Why not?
I don't know. You know, it's something that I literally, if I don't practice those steps, I get all out of whack. And because I find a way to screw up any interpersonal relationship. And it isn't because of always about fleeing or anything. It's my inability to handle conflict.
It's so hard. It's so hard for so many people. But you know what though? I don't think it's weird to call it George. I'm not even joking. Because so I know someone with OCD that names their inner voice Jack. Right? To give it a name. So if you name this technique George, it's an easy way for someone to say, oh, I have to do George now.
Yeah.
So that's not weird.
I'm going to get some weird looks if I say I need to do George now.
Hey, yeah, or whatever.
Say, I need to talk to my friend George.
Okay, that's better.
That's good. I need to talk to my friend George. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I like that, yeah.
That's cool, and it's different. So, wait, Evan, what were you saying? We are actually, we are out of time, and this has been such a great episode. So.
Yeah, thank you. This has been really insightful.
Really insightful. And I hope you'll come back and hang out with us again.
Oh, I hope. No, you got to invite me back. I had fun. I can talk about this stuff all day. I enjoy it.
So tell us where to follow you on Twitter.
You can follow me at BPD in Waterloo. That's BPDINWATERLOO.
Okay, and do you have a blog or website?
No, but I could talk about the 30 seconds about the project I launched, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, just my quick plug. I recently launched a mental health initiative called Project I Am Not Ashamed. It's gaining actually some media attention. I just sat here at the kitchen table here one day. I'm like, I gotta do something. I gotta get out and help break the stigma. This is an event that takes people out into the streets on August 18th of this year within their community and basically outing themselves. They're gonna write on a sign, I have, and for me, borderline personality disorder, I'm not ashamed, hashtag Project I'm Not Ashamed. Right now we have we're 3 weeks in, not even 19 days in. We have participants represented in 10 states, 26 cities, and 4 countries thus far. So it's growing quickly.
That's fantastic.
That's awesome.
Well, thank you so much, and we will see you next time.
All right.